Today, in conversation with Nicholas Henriksen, Andres Garcia, and Lorenzo Garcia Maya, linguists at the University of Michigan and three lead researchers for the collaborative project From Africa to Patagonia, Voices of Displacement. This is an interdisciplinary and intergenerational research project examining a very unique cultural and linguistic contact situation between Spanish and Afrikaans. Through working with a remote community in Patagonia, Argentina that traces its roots back to South African Boers displaced to Patagonia, we're offered a powerful example of how language is tied to cultural identity. Welcome to the We Are We Speak podcast, and we're really excited to have you on the show. I'm Aaliyah. I'm one of your co-hosts today. I'm here with
Juan Freites, and I'm the co-host of the podcast.
Yeah, so we're here to talk about From Africa to Patagonia, Voices of Displacement. This is a really super cool project. Just doing lots of work and research into this project, I was sitting thinking, what is displacement? What does that mean? How might this be like applicable to people who don't know about it? And I was thinking, English is the language that I came up with. Based on what language is and how language changes and shifts, it could have been any other language, depending on what happened to my people 100, 200, 300 years ago. We have these ties to our identity. It translates to so many things for people, but it could have been something else. So I just kind of want to start there and understand a little bit about who you all are, your connection to the project, and like what even first sort of ignited interest in doing this.
Okay, I will begin. I'm Andres Garcia, a member of this research team and the one member of the team who speaks Afrikaans. So I obviously grew up in South Africa, which, you know, other than this tiny community in Argentina, is the only place in the world where people speak Afrikaans. If you grow up in South Africa in the white Afrikaans-speaking community as I did, you know about this community. They are, you know, the thing of lore. So in the Afrikaans community that I grew up in, they are often thought of as like, you know, the real speakers of Afrikaans. And, you know, those Afrikaans speakers who refused to accept British rule and left South Africa to get away from the British. So I've known about them my whole life. And you periodically read about them in the local media, you know, like once in every 10 years, a member of the community will come to South Africa and will be paraded on television and radio. So we all kind of know about them. I just never thought I would have the opportunity to visit them, let alone, you know, have a multi-year long research project studying their language and their experience of you know, being this community in rural desert Patagonia, disconnected from South Africa where they came from, until I met Nick and Lorenzo, right? So I have thought, I would love to do this project, but I don't speak Spanish, and thought, therefore, you know, it's just a dream. And then I met these two guys. So you take over.
Yeah, and it was very interesting because, you know, we really had this conversation about this community over coffee one Friday. We used to hang out on Fridays, I think, afternoons, you know, to kind of get to know each other. Nick and I arrived in Michigan in 2012, and I think it was like a year or so later.
It was about December 2013 when we had the first conversation. Andres had always, I think, you know, just sprinkled in information about the community prior to that, but the sort of the first serious conversation that we had was December 2013, sort of at the end of the semester. We were having a get together with linguists, and it was just the three of us who showed up. And so that was sort of Andre sort of more formally brought up the conversation and the collaboration, and that's sort of where the project emerged.
And I remember that Andres was very, at the beginning, he was sort of skeptical, right? He said, you know, I have a little bit of grant money, maybe we could afford a trip, but I'm not 100% sure that they're Afrikaans, that they still speak the language, you know, that they may, that we just don't know. So it's possible that they only speak Spanish. And then there were a number of exchanges via Facebook with members of the community and also relatives of them that live like 1,000 miles away in Buenos Aires, in the capital. And then I started chatting with them also in Spanish. And eventually, you know, we sort of realized that, yes, there is a community of people older, you know, the youngest person perhaps 60s, early 60s. But there may be still some members that speak Afrikaans fluently. And, you know, we just started talking about it. And I remember that we were very enthusiastic. And Andries, a little more reserved, you know, was like, well, you know.
Lorenzo said I was skeptical. I think I am naturally skeptical about everything. And this, you know, my skepticism about the feasibility of this project was a part of that. The two of you, and specifically Lorenzo, is naturally optimistic. So I think we needed the two, or sometimes I think unrealistically optimistic, we needed the two to make this project work.
So long story short, you know, we established contact with some members of the community, and then I think that Nick and I first went to Buenos Aires and met the relatives of the members. And, you know, it was kind of like a rite of passage. They wanted just to check that we were good people. They have had in the community some prior history with journalists from South Africa that had portrayed them sort of negatively in newspapers and magazines, right? And there was some concern in general by members of the community, you know, both the bilingual speakers and also the relatives that, you know, didn't want them to have any negative experience with people from the outside. And, you know, when they realized that we were really professors from the University of Michigan, that we wanted to do research, then, you know, they started interacting with us and we were sort of like allowed to move on to Comodoro Rivadavia.
To kind of respond to your question, Aliyah, about sort of the origin of the project and sort of actually to tie it together to sort of your very first comment about displacement, I think there's something about this project, the community, that sort of attracts the three of us. Like, there's something that keeps us going, right? I mean, there are many projects that you do in your career that you do it for a couple of years, you pick it up, and then you move on, right? But there's a certain sort of impetus for us to keep going. And I think on a more abstract level, the displacement idea is something that really brings us, you know, back to the community and back to this project. And so, for you know, Lorenzo and Andres, for example, are both examples of folks who are displaced, right? They do not reside in their home country. They no longer speak most commonly their home language, right? And I think there is sort of a connection that they're able to establish with the community members just by virtue of that. In my case, it's a little bit more, there is a connection, and it took me a while to actually realize it. And I actually didn't realize it until about a couple of months into sort of the collaboratory project, which we can talk about a little bit later, being funded, which is that the displacement that we're sort of documenting here is sort of, there are two levels of displacement, or two processes of displacement with respect to Afrikaans language, right? So as you know, as folks might know, you know, Afrikaans, you know, originates from the Dutch colonial project, right? The establishment of the Dutch East India Company on the southern tip of Africa in 1652. And that's sort of how, you know, Afrikaans has developed as its own language in what is modern day South Africa. That's sort of one level of displacement, right? But there's another process of displacement, which is the one that we are in our project documenting, the Boers displacement from what was the southern tip of Africa to, you know, Argentina, right? And so we're documenting, you know, Patagonian Afrikaans, right? You know, in my personal history, so my mom was born and raised in Trinidad and Tobago, and she is a fourth generation speaker of Hindi, right? And so her ancestors, you know, they were displaced from India to Trinidad and Tobago, and then she herself, you know, was displaced from Trinidad and Tobago to New York. So the variety of English and the knowledge she has of Hindi, for example, does actually involve sort of two levels of displacement, right? Or two processes of displacement, right? And integration and all that requires. And so it took me a while to realize that's something also that I identify with this project, right? With the community in a way that maybe other people might not. So getting back to your original question, I think the origin of the project has to do with each one of us, right, and our personal stories, and what kind of keeps us coming back to sort of asking questions about the community, thinking about further collaboration, and thinking about sort of how we can further the project.
Well,
we're professors. We give long answers.
I like that.
It's great.
I think it's cool to hear your personal like motivations and personal connections that come to this. The thing that I was surprised to hear is how you like grew up hearing about this community and that there were somehow mystical or something. So that was just sort of something that stood out to me. And how did they even end up in this particular place? And from the little that I could tell was that there was messaging to come to this place from the Argentine government. Hey, there's cheap land here. It's fertile. And that was the thing. I don't know. It makes me think like it could have been any other government that they were responding to those messages, and it would be a much different story, even if there would be a lot of things similar to it. So anyway, what are you thinking?
No, too many things, but I don't have a specific question right now. But yeah, I was just thinking about what you were saying about displacement. And I mean, I also, you know, I come from Venezuela and moved to this country 23 years ago. And there is a lot of personal experiences that I have with language that, I mean, I hadn't given it the name of displacement because I didn't really know, but is that place in between that I feel, because I feel like I lost a lot of my, I don't know, not skills, but I lost a lot of my tools when it comes to speaking Spanish with people from my own country. But I've been here for 23 years and I don't, you know, a lot of people, I don't know, I don't feel like I own a language. I think that's what I want to say. And so I feel in that limbo. And when I was looking at the documentary, I was like, it that's what resonated to me strongly. So
yeah, I would sort of follow up on that. I think when we talk about displacement here, I think another key word here is colonialism, right? Especially with respect to the history, right? So the Spanish that you speak in Venezuela, right, is the product of Spanish colonialism in the Americas, right? The Hindi that my mom speaks in Trinidad and Tobago, or my grandparents speak, is the product of colonialism of the British into the Caribbean. The Afrikaans that Andrea speaks is the product of, you know, the Dutch colonial product, right? And then we've all brought those languages to a different land, right? Mm-hmm. Right. So you don't speak Spanish anymore in Venezuela. You now speak it in the U.S., right? And mm-hmm. Andre speaks Afrikaans in the U.S., and you have to grapple.
Actually, I don't.
Well, okay, there you go.
Because
there's
nobody I can speak it.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. Yeah.
And then how does that affect your identity? How do you, yeah. What is your relationship with Afrikaans in the U.S.?
Yeah. So I was thinking about your comment about, you know, how it's a certain sense of loss of not being able to speak your language anymore. And I share that, and I think this community in Patagonia also share that, a feeling of not being at home. But there's also, I think, the counter to that of people like them and like those of us who are now living in a different country. I've been here for 25 years in the U.S. So in a sense, we also have two homes. We're at home in two places, right? So you're not at home in a single place, really, but you're also kind of at home in two places. And this community are like that, right? They identify strongly as Afrikaans and from South Africa. It's a core part of their identity, but they are also fully Argentinian, right? They have members of the community that served in the, you know, as in the central Argentinian government as an elected official, right? So they are fully integrated also in that community. And I think that's something that immigrants in general negotiate, is keeping a tie to where you're from and at the same time becoming fully integrated where you are. And you never fully succeed, but at the same time, you kind of have more identities than a non-immigrant. So you have a benefit and a loss there, a gain and a loss.
Wow. I think that's, thank you for sharing that. That's an important thing to pull out. I feel like, and I'm going to speak on behalf of, I'm just going to assume, I think people don't understand like the amount of people who speak this language, because if there are certain celebrity voices, and it's like when you see it in popular media, you're like, well, of course, then there's all these people who know and speak this language and understand it, right? So you think of Charlotte Copley, Charlize Theron, mm-hmm. and like D'Antford, and it's like, great, this must be a robust community. And so like, hearing you share how like that's not necessarily the case, and that there's probably no one here who you can speak it with, I think it's helpful for people to know.
I mean, Afrikaans is a very robust language in South Africa. South Africa has 11 official languages, of which Afrikaans is one. It's the second, amongst the 11 languages, it's the second biggest one as a home language, as a first language. So there's probably around, I don't know, 10 to 12 million people in South Africa who speak the language. a smaller number in Namibia and Botswana, the two neighboring countries. The largest current communities outside of South Africa is found in the prior British Commonwealth, because South Africa is now again part of the Commonwealth, right? So you find them in the UK, in Australia, to some extent in Canada, but very small numbers in the US. And then, you know, this, however many speakers there are left in Patagonia, when we were there, maybe 40, but as Lorenzo said, back then, the youngest one was probably in her 60s, you know, so I think there are now undoubtedly fewer.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, Afrikaans was recently in the news when Charlize Theron, you know, was trying to be funny and said that there's like 8 speakers of the language. Yeah. And there was a lot of upset around that. And one reason for that, for the upset in South Africa, came from, you know, people like me, white speakers of Afrikaans, who is also the kind of Afrikaans that Charlize would speak. But also because around, you know, if we look at the roughly 12 million speakers of Afrikaans in South Africa, only about 40% of them are white. So the majority of speakers of the language are non-white. And during all of the apartheid era, you know, their existence and their affiliation with the language wasn't really recognized. So they also took great offense to Charlize saying the language is basically dying. You know, so their response was, during all of the apartheid years, our existence were denied. And even now, post-apartheid, you, Charlize, is again denying our existence.
Wow. This is, I think, a really great time to, like, pivot to some of the hypotheses of this project. Because one of the things that stood out was about this, like, this idea of legitimacy, I suppose. So I think what you were saying is, you were saying they are potentially aware of their foreignness in this language. And I think one of the findings was that their Spanish influenced their Afrikaans, but not the other way around. And I think you were taking that as evidence for their awareness of their distance, I suppose, from this language. So can we, first of all, correct my understanding of the hypothesis, but also what were some of the things you were testing for or, you know, asking when you were approaching this particular project?
Let's back it up maybe one step, right? So we have linguistic questions, we have sociocultural questions, we have projects that sort of combine the linguistic and the sociocultural. So I think to get at what you're asking about, which is with respect to, you know, the linguistic questions, I think the primary question that we were asking is, to what extent do their two languages influence one another, right? There can be mutual influence, right? Your L1, your first language, can influence your second, and vice versa, right? In a context where you have a community of speakers where they are, they're third generation speakers of Afrikaans, they have limited opportunity to speak Afrikaans. In many cases, their Afrikaans is a little bit attrited, right? It's not as fluent, I'm using air quotes there, as it would have been maybe when they were growing up. And Spanish is the more, I'll use air quotes again, dominant language, right? Because they use it more frequently. You might expect, right, that their Spanish would have more influence over their Afrikaans. But there have been situations in different projects that we've undertaken where we found L1, like Spanish to Afrikaans influence, other projects where we found Afrikaans to Spanish influence, other projects where we found mutual influence, or both, right? And so I think probably the most responsible answer to your question is that it's tricky and it's nuanced, right? And it depends on the phonological or the phonetic factor that you're looking at. It depends on just sort of how the two languages use that phonetic property that you're looking at, whether that property is present in one language or the other. And I think maybe I would pivot here to the project on the field pauses that Lorenzo has worked on.
I'm happy to talk about it. But one thing that I wanted to give you is a little more context, right? So, you know, a lot of what we have is self-reported data of their language use as they were growing up, right? And, you know, self-reported data, if I were to ask you what you did in the last 2 hours regarding language, it could be challenging to ask, right? So imagine if I asked you what you did 60 or 70 or 80 years ago, right? So I kept asking and asking and asking, and I asked in Spanish, Andres asked in Afrikaans, and, you know, sometimes we got responses that were not really the same. So they would say one thing to Andries and one thing to me, right? And one of the questions that that we sort of have this divergent answers was the question of when did you go to school? Because schooling, we know, would happen only in Spanish. And sometimes, you know, in a conversation of about an hour, maybe another hour with Andries, they would change the response, right? So we don't know.
And I don't think it's because they lied.
It's it's because they don't remember.
They don't remember. We're talking about something that happened 70 years ago. And because it's a complicated question, because school wasn't school as we think
about
it. It's an itinerant teacher that went from farm to farm, you know? So you might have school 2 or 3 months out of the year, and next year you might not have school if the teacher doesn't make it to the farm. So, you know, like, when exactly do you begin school in a situation like that?
And that schooling that Andries talking about is different from the one that I'm talking about, right? So I was talking about when they move to the cities, right? They're living in farms and they move to cities, right? Because oil was found, and then, you know, the families decided, through the season, you know, it should be good to have a house in the city so that our children can go to school, right? This seems to be a decision that the families, all the families took at some point, but it's not clear exactly when this move happened. I think that maybe one family started and then they talked to someone else and they decided to do the same thing, right? But originally they were all living in farms. So I heard from one of the speakers that some of this schooling that Andries was referring to actually happened in English, right? So, you know, there were different languages sort of happening. And a number of our Africans, our bilingual speakers, their ancestors, you know, that arrived there had knowledge of more languages than just Afrikaans, right? I remember one of our speakers was still very fluent in English.
Yeah, so most of them would have had basic knowledge of English.
Right.
The British, by the time that they left South Africa in 1902, the British has been there for a century and a half. Mm-hmm. So they've probably had, you know, some school in English. The government might have been English, so they all would have had some knowledge of English.
Right.
And some would have had quite extensive knowledge of English.
Right. But then it has always been difficult for us to know exactly, you know, when this bilingualism, when using both languages, sort of one in the house, perhaps, and another one outside of the house, when it happens, specifically, when it starts for each one of our speakers. This is something that we don't really know. What you have now is people that, you know, if Andries hadn't told me that they speak Afrikaans, I would have thought that they were native speakers of Spanish, right? Like, their Spanish is absolutely excellent. Then, I mean, they're excellent in the sense that you cannot tell that there are traces of any other language, right? But for some people, we did find, you know, some of a bit of a foreign accent, right? Some characteristics at the phonetic level that, you know, or even at the syntactic level that would make us think, oh, you know, perhaps they also speak another language in addition to Spanish. So the project that Nick was talking about is we looked at the field pauses, right? So field pauses are us and ums in English, right? But in Spanish and Afrikaans, pretty much same pronunciation.
Yes. English and Afrikaans are both and as filled pauses.
But in Spanish, we have e and m, right? So they're different. So we looked at the interviews that Andries conducted in Afrikaans and the interviews that both Nick and I conducted in Spanish, and then selected a large numbers of these field pauses, right? And then we looked at F1 and F2 values, which is pretty much measurements that we use in phonetic analysis to look at frontness and backness, right? And, you know, what we were able to see is that when the speakers speak Afrikaans, they're closer to what monolingual Afrikaans speakers, there are not many monolingual Afrikaans speakers because they all speak English, or most of them also speak English, but, you know, people that speak Afrikaans in South Africa, right? So they're kind of like into that cloud. But then when they speak Spanish, you know, it's kind of like they go kind of like to the cloud of the Spanish. So they do make a distinction, right? But their levels are sort of intermediate between the two. So they are not, they're kind of like going through Afrikaans, but not perfectly. You know, it's like, no, they're not around the monolingual speakers when we plot the data, and the same thing happens in Spanish. They go into that direction, but it's always sort of intermediate values that we have. And, you know, that was an interesting result for us because, you know, we wanted to know more about what they were doing with these particles. They're really not words, but in terms of pronunciation, they're treating them like words, right? And, you know, in that paper, sort of hypothesize if really field policy should be considered words to a certain extent because of this particular treatment that that our bilingual speakers were doing of them.
Yeah, but some of the most interesting results in the field pauses study, which you and Sean Lang did,
yeah,
right?
One of our undergrad students.
Yeah. So as on average, when they were speaking Afrikaans, their field pauses were more like, and on average, when they were speaking Spanish, was more like.
Mm-hmm.
But they were those individuals who, when they spoke Afrikaans, they were completely like South African Afrikaans. And when they spoke Spanish, they were basically indistinguishable from Spanish. And then there were people who were in the middle, and there were people who was, everything was Afrikaans-like, even when they were speaking Spanish, or people was, everything was Spanish-like, even when they were speaking Afrikaans. It was a huge variation amongst them. And I tried to, you know, kind of match it to individual people and see, can we, based on what we know about them, understand mm-hmm. it? And for some of them, I thought I could, but I don't think enough that one could make strong conclusions, right? So there's like, the one person who is very Spanish-like in their Spanish filled pauses and very Afrikaans-like in their Afrikaans filled pauses, it's her husband who served in the government. So she was very integrated in Argentinian society and kind of upper class, so probably very good Spanish. But she was also one of the people, when we walked into her house the first time, wanted to make sure that we understand that she speaks Afrikaans, she reads Afrikaans, and that she's definitely part of the Afrikaans community. So I think both identities was really important to her.
Mm-hmm.
And she wanted to be a good Spanish speaker and a good Afrikaans speaker. So I sometimes wonder if there's a personal motivational component to how much their filled pauses was Spanish versus Afrikaans like.
She was extremely careful in her speech. I mean, like, we had some reading tasks in which I would have to read. And, you know, she looked like a professional reader, you know, like someone that could be presenting the news, you know, or something like that. And I think that's something that carried in both languages, right? How careful her speech was, both, you know, in reading tasks and also more conversational tasks that we also had had for them.
The following is a brief excerpt from Richard Finn Gregory's 2015 documentary, The Boers at the End of the World. It features a community member participating in the research project by reading a few predetermined lines of dialogue in Afrikaans.
Goed.
Voordat olie ontdek is, was ons mense almal skaapboere gewees. Ons voorouers het met groot skippe oor die see gevaar na Argentina.
It's so great to hear the differences in her Afrikaans from mine that we came hoping to find. It's definitely there.
So what about some of the questions that spoke that weren't necessarily linguistic based, but more pulling out information about ideologies and identity yeah. and language and culture?
Yeah, sure. So this is a paper that we wrote with one of our collaborators, Ryan Speech, who's also a faculty member at the University of Michigan. He works in the Department of Romance, Languages, and Literatures, which is where Lorenzo and I have our home affiliation. What we did in that project, and that was a collaborative project again, was sort of work through the content of the interviews, right? So just to kind of offer some context, right? So Lorenzo's project is looking just at specific particles and sort of not necessarily looking at the speech that's said. It's like, let's look at this vowel and study it, and then here are some values for, you know, these F1 and F2 and just compare graphs, right? Which is one excellent way of approaching the community, right? Another way of approaching the community is looking at the content of their speech, like actually looking at how they talked about the history of the use of Afrikaans and Spanish in the community, and sort of trying to identify, you know, based on what was said, sort of different stages of language use mm-hmm. from, let's say, the settlement, right, the early 20th century until, you know, modern times, so like, you know, 2018, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I know that, you know, the main finding is that at the time of settlement, right, which is at the start of the 20th century, between then until the point when sort of oil was discovered, right, in the Patagonia region, right, which is sort of the south central region of Argentina, Spanish really wasn't present. It wasn't present as a community language, And there were other languages that were spoken in the area, English, but then also other indigenous languages, right? Spanish didn't really have much cultural capital,
right.
if probably I would say at that point none, little, right? You know, if you're working on the farm, for example, and you're working with other workers on the farm, you know, maybe it's necessary to speak their languages as well, right? You know, I know some members of the community had acknowledged that they spoke, you know, for example, Mapuche, for example, right?
Tehuelche,
exactly. And so and in addition to that, you know, there it was also really clear that the community was very proud of their language and their heritage, right? And so there's sort of a confluence of factors that really makes the community very Afrikaans dominant in the sense that, you know, the language still survives and it is used. And there's no reason to sort of acclimate yourself to Spanish culture or Spanish language until about the early 1950s, right? Which is sort of when oil is discovered. And then that sort of attracts a lot of companies and businesses and Spanish-speaking folks from Buenos Aires into Patagonia. And then that's sort of where we start seeing sort of the more common shift where community members shift from, you know, their heritage language to the what we'll call now the majority language, right? In which is Spanish, right? And so just to sort of contrast that, you know, most instances of displacement, right, where we have immigrants arrive to a new land, right, that shift typically happens, you know, in the, let's say, sort of almost immediately, right? So such that the second generation, right, that is the children of the immigrants, are already becoming more dominant in the majority language, right? With the case of the Afrikaans Spanish bilingual community in Patagonia, that process was offset by one generation, right? So it wasn't really until the third generation, right, whereby those members or the folks that we spoke with still preserve Afrikaans, but they became more dominant in Spanish, right? Second generation members, right? Second generation, that is the children of the original settlers, from my understanding, we didn't speak with them, were extremely proficient in Afrikaans. And mm-hmm. and some of them had very limited knowledge of Spanish because of the mentions of the factors that I mentioned. And I think from our standpoint, we were able to sort of extract those factors and sort of synthesize sort of the history, right? And sort of pinpoint different reasons why this shift was delayed by doing a qualitative analysis of the interviews that we conducted with the speakers while we were on site. I said a lot there, and I'm sure my two collaborators might want to follow up on some things that I said.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, just to clarify, yeah. Like this shift that you're describing, right? Like there's like a model or something, and that's how they found that like this is typically going to happen within a certain amount of generations. Not that you, per this project, just decided they shifted late, right? So just to clarify, this has been looked at, and that's sort of why I think one of the reasons why this community stands out is really unique. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's the so-called Fishman model that says, you know, usually you shift.
Yes. Yeah.
Usually the shift happens immediately, and in this community, that shift happened like 40 years after settlement for well-understood historical reasons. But that is the reason why 120 years later, Afrikaans was still there, right? So we could still study it. In a typical immigrant community, 120 years later, we wouldn't have been able to study it. So the language survived longer.
Following is an excerpt from The Boers at the End of the World, featuring Nick, Andres, and Lorenzo, talking a little bit about the research project, including some of the findings that have been standing out to them so far.
They definitely do things that are remnants of an older variety of Afrikaans. There's some pronunciation things, right? So I would say kinders, and they have kinders.
One feature that is salient to us is that
stops,
right? So B and D between vowels in Spanish are pronounced as approximants.
Their Spanish is also phenomenally good. So they are really controlling both of these languages mm-hmm. at a very high level yeah. of proficiency.
We need to label these as who is generation two, who is generation three. And there are exceptions, but here we have a case of a lot of generation three speakers who speak really, really well.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the situation was quite extraordinary, right?
Yeah.
In the sense that they were really isolated.
Originally, arrived Afrikaans was probably the dominant language
yeah.
for a few
yeah.
decades.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Well, Welsh in other regions, mm-hmm. yes.
I want to go back to the story that Nick told about this study, the kind of cultural study. So some of the interesting things. And I was a co-author on that paper, but I was less involved in it because you were looking at the Spanish interviews and I don't speak or read Spanish. So I was more an outsider in a sense. some of the interesting things for me was to see how the stories that people told about how they felt about Afrikaans and Spanish, and how some people had a much more positive attitude towards Afrikaans and some a less positive attitude. And stories they told about how they were proud of speaking Afrikaans as children, and stories about how they were ridiculed when they spoke Afrikaans or spoke Spanish poorly. So their relationship to the language also, I think, shifted depending on the stage of life they were in and on the social settings that they were. And some of those narratives were emotionally wrenching, you know, when they spoke about their relationship to both of their two languages.
Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, going back to the schooling, right, when they went to schools with other native speakers of Spanish, some of the stories that they told us were really portraying bullying, right? And they, I think that all of them, really, from memory, speaking from memory, I think that all of them reported some degree of it because they were not able to speak Spanish proficiently. Some of them started schooling, I remember, let's say between ages 8 and 15, right? Many of them reporting ages after 12. So, you know, they were adolescents, right? They were very aware of what's going on. And, you know, sometimes they reported that the teachers would punish them or make them sit very close to them, you know, because it's like they couldn't hear and that's why they couldn't understand, or they would be sort of screamed at, right, or yelled at in an attempt to make them understand better. But you know, this was something that went on for years for some of them. And one of the things that I noticed in the interviews is that some of the participants would want to expand on this, perhaps indicating that the trauma is still very real for them, even though they are 70, in their 70s, 80s. Some people spend a little less time discussing it. But, you know, if you ask an additional question or two about how that was, it was problematic, right? Some people, I mean, I'm not going to say that some people are more resilient than others, but, you know, some people find ways, right, to interact more. They realize, okay, so I have to work more on my Spanish. I mean, eventually they all had a very high level of proficiency in the language, right? But how they were able to get this, you know, it's not like traditional learners, you know, that study a second language because they want to and in a positive environment. I mean, they were really sort of, they realized that they had to do it, you know, perhaps in order to survive, right, and to be able to develop a living and whatnot in the area, in the place where they were living.
So I guess, yeah, this is all excellent. So I guess maybe what I can do is to sort of maybe synthesize through a little bit of an analogy here, right? So let's say, you know, we have Afrikaans monolinguals at the 0-yard line, Spanish monolinguals at the 100-yard line, right? The bilinguals in Spanish are about, the bilinguals in Afrikaans are about the 25-yard line. So they're not with the Afrikaans monolinguals. They're actually somewhere in between, and they're being pulled in the Spanish direction, right? The bilinguals in Spanish, they're at about the 75-yard line, right? They're not totally at the goalpost of the Spanish comparisons. They're being pushed in the direction of Afrikaans, right? And so that's sort of what we kind of find, that they're sort of intermediate. Does that analogy make sense?
Yes.
Okay. But so if that doesn't make sense, I need to know now, because it gets complicated.
It's already afterwards. Complicated.
I have a picture in my head. Yes. I'm like, do they have on helmets and uniforms okay. in this okay. analogy?
So, but generally, like, so their Afrikaans is not fully like Afrikaans-like. Their Spanish is not fully Spanish-like. They're kind of intermediate.
Yes.
Right? And that's why they're on the 25 and the 75 yard line. However, in a different paper published in Phonetica, what we did was we sort of switched up the task they were doing, right, the speaking task. They did a sort of a code-switching task where, like, they would start a sentence in Afrikaans and then switch to Spanish, right? Or they would start a sentence in Spanish and switch to Afrikaans, right? And a really fascinating finding from that paper is that starting a sentence in Afrikaans and switching into Spanish makes their Spanish really Afrikaans-like, but not vice versa. What we were able to do in that paper was shift their Spanish, which was on the 75-yard line, all the way down to Afrikaans, uh-huh. right? But not shift their Afrikaans, which is on the 25-yard line, into Spanish, right? And so that's a really impressive finding, because it shows that that the first language that you speak is really, really important, right? It sort of is, it's persistent, right, cognitively, and it can, and when you sort of find ways to have those two languages interact, right, they don't end up at the 50, at the midpoint of the football field, right? It's the first language shifts you all the way to where Afrikaans is, but not vice versa. Does that make sense?
Yes. That makes sense. Yes. Can we sort of, that makes sense, but can we clarify whether or not we should perceive that as a positive or a negative, this idea of being set back or set back to the 0-yard line? I don't know enough about football to know
if
that's
like a bad thing. Either do I.
Like, because that's where they start. No, but they don't start. But does that make sense? Like, can you clarify if that finding should indicate some sort of negative
I don't,
or positive?
I don't think it's
speaker?
Negative or positive. Okay. It is just how language works in the mind of a bilingual speaker. It's
exactly.
just the cognitive representation of languages in the minds of all bilingual speakers, not just this community, right? You, if you're a bilingual or a multilingual, you're constantly negotiating the activation of all your grammars as you use your language. And it's fascinating to see how those languages, how those grammars interact. And what we found in this case was that when you put in bilingual speakers to activate both grammars by making them switch between the two languages, for this group, the first language, Afrikaans for them, the language they acquired first, just exerted way more influence than Spanish, the language they acquired later. And what makes that in this case particularly interesting is although they learned Afrikaans first, for the last 50 years of their lives, Spanish has been their dominant language. Mm-hmm. So this first acquired language retained this prominence in the cognitive representation even after decades of very little opportunity to use it. So just kind of showing the persistence of early language exposure.
Wow. Yeah.
Do you... I'm sorry, I'm inside my head like, yes, because I have two daughters. One is 5.5 and the other one is 2.5. And I've spoken Spanish to them since they were born. And my mom is the one who watches them. And my mom only speaks Spanish. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, yes, because I'm just wondering how to have that prominence, does it have to be like a number of years, or do you guys have an idea about that, or...
Yeah, Lorenzo is our second language
Everyone's
expert.
Everyone's like pointing, yes.
Because I'm like, oh, if I keep, you know, they keep going and maybe they'll
Can I add
retain
an element, or does it have to do with like pride? Do you need to instill in them like,
well,
this is the best language in order for it to be prominent?
I kind of done that already.
But first of all, let me say something important. As linguists, we don't pass judgment on linguistic behaviors, right?
Okay.
So, you know, what you're doing, I think, is fantastic, right? But how your children feel about Spanish, time will tell.
Yeah.
Because it may depend on the interaction that they begin having on Spanish with you and other people, and also the role that English plays on their lives, right? And that we just don't know. I mean, we don't know if you're going to be here forever, they're going to be here forever, or if you're going to decide to go back to a country with Spanish as the majority language, right? So that could really change. I think it's wonderful that people decide to keep their ancestors' language alive in the household, because that's going to make your children bicultural, not only bidialectal, right? Not only bilinguals, but they're going to have fully appreciation of the culture here, and also the culture in Venezuela, I would say back home, right? But as Andrés said, you know, it's two homes for them now. So you know, that's what I can say about that specific example. Now, the question that you have specifically, can you repeat that for me?
I don't know how to phrase the question, but so Andrés was saying that there was a prominence of African,
right?
Because of that was the first acquired language. So I was just wondering how... You know, if you have an idea, how long do you have to keep that going so they actually keep that prominence of the first acquired language?
What we know is that really it's going to depend on exposure to the language and language use, not just exposure, right? So, for example, so your you have two children, so probably the first had more opportunities, only Spanish, right? To use Spanish as the language in the household because that's the language that she would interact with people around, right?
Yep.
But then she went to school, right? Started going to school, and school is in English, I assume. So your second child probably is going to end up at points speaking in English with her sister.
Yes.
Right? And then you're going to have to negotiate how, what you do in that case, right? Mm-hmm. So you can keep talking in Spanish, but it's possible that if they know, and they probably know that you speak English, they will answer back in English, right? Mm-hmm. Has this started already?
Yes, yes.
Okay. So we know, right, that this is what happens. But then it really depends on the household and depends on, for example, if you're going to take trips back home. And, you know, when really using English is going to sort of isolate them, which, you know, would be something that they wouldn't like, right? So they would prefer probably to talk to cousins and friends and other family members in the language. So for that, you kind of need the whole community using Spanish. But if they remain here through the rest of their lives, they may use Spanish, but, you know, the level of proficiency may not be there. Regarding this prominence, I mean, perhaps we do the study with them. I don't know if we'll get the same results because English started a lot earlier in their lives than Spanish became part of the lives of our bilingual speakers. I mean, we're talking about Spanish becoming sort of the language that they would use the most, starting ages 12, 13, 14, 15, right? But your children started learning English how old when they went to school? When the first one went to school?
2.5.
So you see the big difference, right, that we have here. Yeah. So it's really like we believe, and some of them mentioned, that they were sort of strictly monolingual speakers of Afrikaans for their entire childhood, right?
Yeah, I mean, some of them kind of until age 18 or 20 when they moved into town to take a job. So if they lived on the farm until then, they spoke predominantly Afrikaans for, you know, a long part of their lives. So I think the amount of exposure and use, but there's also what is the social cultural setting in which it happens, right? What does it mean to speak each of these languages? And that I don't know what it means to speak Spanish in America or in your household, but for these Afrikaans speakers in Argentina, you know, their identity, it's so tied to the language that it has it's a definitional part of who they are. And the community in which they live, the city of Comodoro Rivadavia, is a city of immigrants that values and celebrates being an immigrant. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's multiple of these immigrant communities of which they are the probably biggest or most prominent one because they were the first one. But, you know, on the day when they arrived from Africa, you know, that's a kind of a holiday in the city where the mayor comes and gives a speech and they march down the street. And then on the day when, you know, the Czech community arrived, then the same thing happens. So there's a valuing of what it means to be an immigrant there that I think is not necessarily present in modern American society. Okay. So I think those social settings also influences how much you retain the heritage language.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Awesome.
But I think Juan, your question is great because I think many listeners are in a similar situation to you and sort of want to understand how and what parallels exist between the Afrikaans, Spanish, bilingual community of Patagonia and immigrant communities in the U.S., right? And I think, you know, a really big difference that I would emphasize here is that in 2023, you know, we have English, the majority language, on TV. It's on the street. It's in the store, right? So there is that exposure there, right? And with the community that we're working with, I mean, their exposure to Spanish was probably nothing, right, for the first 10 to 15 years of their lives, right? And so there just wasn't any social capital, right? In addition to there not being any input, there just wasn't any social capital or any cultural capital to using Spanish, right? So I think that's one difference. And the other difference is the length of time, which I think Lorenzo mentioned, right? I mean, exposure to Spanish did happen much later on in life, right, than what you might see in typical heritage communities in the U.S., right? And so I'll sort of problematize another sort of dichotomy that we often talk about in linguistic research, which is, you know, heritage communities and second language learner communities, right? Heritage communities would be your children, Juan, right? Whose parents, you know, are native speakers of another language, and they're being brought up at home in their parents' language, right, the heritage language, but are also being exposed to the majority language in school, right, and television and XYZ, right? And what Lorenzo mentioned is a classic example of what happens, right? Once the first child goes out into school and realizes that the majority language is the language of play, then that child brings that language into the household, and even though they may speak to you, their parent, their caretaker, in Spanish, they're probably speaking to their siblings in the majority language because they just have made that association, right? Second language learners are much more common in the U.S., right? Somebody like me, for example, you know, I grew up speaking English in my home, and I didn't start speaking Spanish till about 12 or 13, right? Or learning Spanish, right? The Afrikaans Spanish community in Patagonia is somewhere in between. And so they're not like either one of those. They're sort of somewhere in between. And we just mentioned that there are ways in which they resemble heritage communities. There are ways in which they resemble second language speakers, but there are ways in which they don't resemble both of those groups. And that's probably important just to mention.
Yes.
Okay. we agree.
Yes.
But, you know, Juan should feel comfortable that if you keep the language going, you know, that's going to have a very positive effect, you know, on your children. And I'm sure that, you know, if you have a network, a social network of native speakers, of speakers of Spanish, let's put it that way, and your children are part of it, that's really going to have super positive effects, you know, in their upbringing and also their views of Spanish, right? As a second language in the U.S. I mean, let's remember that. It's a very different story with Afrikaans, who's a truly hyper-minority language in Argentina. But Spanish, I mean, is also quite alive in the U.S. I mean, with more than 40 million speakers in this country using it every single day.
More on the Patagonia Project in part 2.